House Bill 3346. We're going to do a public hearing on first. Mr. Joseph.
Thank you. Let me get myself together here for a second.
That's all right. It's one of those days.
This is fine. My SMS on that one.
All right.
This is Thursday. And this would be my last day with you guys, except for I will make a surprise appearance on Monday.
All right.
I'm just reading what this bill does.
All right, anybody who cares about this bill, come forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3346 authorizes Metro to record a final order assessing a civil penalty for the county clerk, and it brings Metro's laws into accord with state laws so that Metro can assess civil penalties for environmental regulations, including anti-dumping and other type of environmental protections.
All right. Thank you very much, Doug.
No problem.
All right. Doug and others?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Riggs, here on behalf of Metro. And we appreciate the time this morning. We'll try not to take too much of your time. This bill passed 8-0 in the House Judiciary Committee and 54-2 on the House floor. The two votes were unrelated to what I think the bill was related to. There were two no votes on every bill that day on the House floor. I'm going to only spend a moment or two and give you some general context on this issue. The bottom line is that, like most urban jurisdictions, especially when the economy turns down, we see a rash of people traveling the streets of Portland and preying upon folks who might have garbage sitting in their front yard or backyard or side yard, walking up to their door and offering them for a small fee to dispose of this garbage, or walking up to the building and offering to dispose of the garbage, and then turning around and disposing of it illegally, either in a remote area or, as some of the examples that I've handed out to you explain, parking it on the street and then leaving it there. Metro was given jurisdiction a number of years ago by the state to take action against these fly-by-night operations, and we attempt to do so, and as Paul Garahan, Metro's deputy attorney, will tell you in a few minutes, we have quite a few reports and actions taken against people. Unfortunately, what we've discovered is that because state law has changed over the last few years, we no longer believe that in cases where a lien is to be imposed and the person who the lien is being imposed against appeals, that we have as much authority as we need to make the lien stick. And as a result, there's some question about whether or not Metro would have to go back to a second proceeding in a circuit court in addition to the hearing the Metro Council takes to be able to enforce the action. And so this bill, we believe, is a technical fix that will get us back to the way the system was set up 25 years ago to give Metro that authority. And I'll turn it over to Paul Garahan with Metro.
All right, great. Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Garahan, Assistant Metro Attorney. As Doug explained, Metro has an administrative enforcement process and which we use to prosecute illegal dumpers and others who have violated Metro's solid waste ordinances. And what this bill will do is to put Metro in the same position. These are administrative enforcement proceedings like those taken by state agencies, and this will allow, will clarify that Metro has the authority to enforce the orders coming out of those administrative hearings, hearings that are very protective of the due process rights of those accused of the infractions. And Metro will then be able to enforce its civil penalty orders by having them filed with the county clerks. And what this will do is avoid a situation where if the civil penalties were not paid after they had been ordered and hearings had been held, now Metro would have to go back to circuit court again and might have to start the hearing process all over again. And I think especially given the workload of our courts at this time, this would help to lighten that burden. In any of these cases, the final order can still be appealed to circuit court by the writ of review process. So there is still the option for the person against whom the order is entered to appeal Metro's actions to the court. But in cases where Metro has clear authority and it's not being contested, this will help us to collect the civil penalties that are imposed. As Doug Riggs said, there are quite a few of these cases. In the last 2 years, there have been Metro has received over 300 cases per year in just the illegal dumping area alone. Metro has, on average, over two dozen hearings each year, not counting an average of approximately three dozen defaults where hearings are scheduled and the accused does not show up, and also not counting approximately two dozen citations issued where the penalties are just paid without a hearing. So those are some of the statistics about the illegal dumpers, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions that any members of the committee have.
All right. Questions?
Thank you.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Gentlemen, what happens when your lien is recorded in the county clerk lien record? How do you collect? I assume you don't go bust kneecaps. There must be some other way to do it.
That's right, Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker. When something is recorded in the county clerk lien record, then we can enforce it using the same procedures that you would enforce a court judgment. So it's the equivalent of a court judgment at that point, and that's what gives us the authority to go put a lien on if the respondent has property anywhere in the state, we could put a lien on the property. That would be the primary method of enforcing that judgment.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions? There are none. Doug, final comments.
Good bill should pass.
Work session.
Thank you.
Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I agree. I move House Bill 3346 to the Senate floor with a two-pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Burdick moves House Bill 3346 to the floor of the Senate with a two-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? No discussion. Any objections to the motion? There are none. Passes. Any volunteers to carry the bill?
It's your district. Go for it.
Senator Burdick, volunteer. Thank you very much. And let me see. I guess we got Senator Dukes here on 66. On 3338, is Representative Crummell out there somewhere?
He's not here, but I do see Rob Pope here to testify on the bill, but he is not here.
Okay, all right. Then let's do the 666. Open up a public hearing on this amendment, I guess, dealing with the gut and stuff. Senator Dukes.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Joan Dukes, State Senator from District 16, and I want to thank Senator Starr for his graciousness in allowing us to amend a bill that he introduced. And I will tell you a brief story, and that will explain why I'm here with this amendment. This past spring, as you know, there are some parts of the state that are high enough that the snow and the ice hangs on longer than it does in other parts. And Highway 26 in my district is one of those. And this spring we had had a group that regularly transports veterans from Clatsop County to the Veterans Hospital. And they actually requested an extension of the studded tire law for them to be able to continue using studded tires on Highway 26. They were denied because there is nothing in the law that allows ODOT to extend the time unless the commission itself determines that they should extend it for the entire state. So for somebody who's doing medical transport, and it's not an emergency medical transport, there's no way to accommodate that. So they did the transport, and we're on Highway 26, hit a patch, there was ice and snow, hit a patch of ice, rolled the van, went off the highway, and did serious damage to the people who were inside. The good news is that everyone lived, but there was an 84-year-old veteran who was badly broken up, as well as others who had serious broken bones and such. And so what this amendment does is simply allow that motor vehicles used for regularly scheduled medical transport services would be exempt from the studded tire law. It allows, I mean, that we carefully crafted it to narrow it down so it's not very many vehicles that would be in this situation. We do not know for sure that studded tires would have made a difference in this situation, but we don't know that it wouldn't have, and they are simply asking that they be able to add that piece to something they can do in order to be able to get these folks safely over the mountain.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Brady.
Well, it was the judgment at the time, however, by the driver that they really wanted studded tires.
Yes, the organization that transports them had made that request before the transport ever happened, just because of the conditions on that highway. So, yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ringer.
This question about the language. It says motor vehicles used for regularly scheduled medical transport services. Does that imply that regular schedule is at least once a week or once a month or what? I just want to make sure we're not talking about you've got some vehicle and once a year they drive to see their dentist and they say, see, I get to use studs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, we expect that it will be on a, I don't know how to define regular schedule. So, yes, once a week, once a month, once a quarter, but with some frequency.
I see. Something where there's a set schedule.
Yeah,
that meeting that schedule.
I think that's it exactly, Senator, a set schedule.
Okay. Thank you very much.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burke.
In these vehicles, this was a van in this case, and these vehicles aren't used for medical transport services. They can just be driven around everywhere during the interim.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, they can, but not with the studded tires. This exemption is for the transport of medical folks.
That really is not what it says here. It says motor vehicles used for regularly scheduled medical transport services. So it would look to me from this amendment that if it's used for that purpose, then they're exempt. And it doesn't. I don't see where it's exempt on a trip-by-trip basis.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that is correct. That's the way the language reads.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I mean, I guess just a comment. I think it has to read that way. I mean, it'd be kind of cumbersome to say, okay, now you're going to do the medical run. Now you have to change the tires. And I guess I would hope that we still give some discretion to these folks so that when summer really does arrive, they can take off their studs. But I don't know a good way to make it so that it serves your purpose that it's worded differently.
Right. Are these services licensed or regulated in some way, or are we just talking about private vehicles being used for this purpose that are unlicensed?
Mr. Chair, the one that I'm referring to is a county veterans situation. More than that, I can't tell you. I know that there won't be many of these. At least that's my understanding. I don't have a better answer than that.
Do we know if medical transport services is defined anywhere? And would it be necessary to define it?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. Legislative Council gave me this language, and I can only assume that if it needed to be defined, they would have defined it.
Well, it's not necessarily.
I was trying.
But that's a good shot. Anyway. All right. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dukes, do these people who get an exemption have to make an application to ODOT to get their exemption, or do they just get it by virtue of being one of these exceptions here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, they will get it by virtue of being on the list, just as school buses and emergency vehicles get it.
So then anybody could say they were an emergency vehicle, a medical transport vehicle, and just not have to make application and prove that they were a medical transport vehicle?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we're wandering over into areas I am no expert in,
okay,
but this is the law. And so if someone were to say that they were and they were stopped or in an accident or whatever, and it was determined that they were not a regularly scheduled medical transport service, then they could be cited.
Maybe Mr. Tindall can clarify anything that we've asked here that went beyond Senator Dukes's knowledge.
Okay, thanks. Senator Minnis, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, State Maintenance Engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Actually, Senator Dukes has done a wonderful job answering the questions. In fact, she answered a couple I don't think I could have. The last, with respect to what is a regularly scheduled medical transport, we would have two options. We could either define that in rule or, as Senator Dukes said, and probably with some sort of frequency on it, or as Senator Dukes said, it would be, you can always, there are a number of exemptions in traffic laws, and you can always be cited and claim that you are exempt because of one of those various exemptions. Then you have to prove that you're actually exempt.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I like the idea of defining in rule what a medical transport vehicle is so that it satisfies some of the questions that we've had, because I just have this disdain for set of tires generally and think that we should be charging people to use them, and we don't. And we're just giving one more exemption, but it does seem to be a valuable exemption, even though Senator Dukes has admitted on the record that studded tires may or may not have helped that accident, kept that accident from happening, but we don't know, so we'll just play it safe. So thank you.
Mr. Chair. Senator Birdie.
So are you saying it's the department's intention to do rulemaking around this?
Senator Minnis, Senator Burdick, yes, it is now.
I think what we're trying to avoid here is somebody, you know, who may have a weekly medical appointment for a,
sure,
a physical condition sliding in under this, when the intent is for some kind of mass transit, if you will, of
Chairman and Senator Burdick, almost all of the traction laws are already in rule, so it's just a small amendment to the existing rule.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I guess I do want to clarify that. Is this intended only for mass transit vehicles, or, I mean, why should it apply to somebody who's getting their regular dialysis treatment? I mean, if they're just a private citizen, I don't know why that would apply any differently to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I anticipated that this would be more than one individual at a time, although there's no requirement that it is, but it does refer to regularly scheduled medical transport services. And I suppose that a dial-a-ride service could decide to do regular medical transport as long as it was regularly scheduled, and perhaps on Tuesday they only had one person riding in the van and on Thursday they had five, that it would qualify.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
I think what I'm trying to avoid here, and I know that Senator Dukes would not want this outcome either, is somebody who maybe uses their family car, you know, once every 3 months for a regularly scheduled appointment of some kind, and then during the rest of the 3 months,
sure,
they're exempt from the law. That's what we're trying to avoid here, and I'm sure Senator Dukes is very, very genial with that motion.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, absolutely. And again, where it says medical transport services, I think that ODOT will likely define that word services to narrow this down.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree that you have done a fabulous job knowing the substance of this area, so thank you.
All right. I assume this might also cover taxis that would be engaged in medical transport.
Mr. Chair, I doubt that it would, because taxis, generally speaking, I don't believe are regularly scheduled medical transport. Now, if they wanted to do that, if they wanted to say every third Tuesday we take people to the hospital or to dialysis or to whatever.
I think they actually do.
Some,
particularly in the
Portland
metro
city,
area,
see.
do that.
You're from the big city. You have stuff we don't have out in the rural
area. Mr. Chair, do you even have taxi service in Astoria?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes, we have taxi service in Astoria.
Chairman,
and we lost the covered wagons a few years ago.
Touché.
A great amendment for you, Senator.
We want Metro to manage your taxi service.
Oh, this has been great fun this morning.
All right. All right, where are we here?
Well,
we have to do work session for work session.
Okay.
Senator Ringo moves the adoption of the dash one amendment. Discussion? And I think for the record, we want to make sure that the department is, I think, stated to would draft a rule or rules that would narrow this sufficiently to make everyone happy. And any further discussion? Any objections? No objection. Motion passes. Senator Dukes, I assume you'd like to carry this.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, first of all, let's move the bill.
Yeah, we just moved the amendment.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I would move. Whenever anyone jumps in and does my job, they just don't do it right. I move Senate Bill 666 as amended to the Senate floor with the Dukes recommendation.
All right, Senator Burrick now moves Senate Bill 666 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Just one comment that one of these days I do want to get a bill that charges people to use studded tires.
Here's your opportunity.
I know.
Any further discussion? Any objections? No objection. Motion passes. Senator Dukes, now. Carry the bill. Thank you very much. All right. 3338, Council. What does this bill do?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, actually do know what this bill does. This bill deals with adoptions, and specifically it deals with a situation where a non-custodial parent seeks custody or partial custody of a child. This bill would require the court to take a look at the involvement or the level of involvement that that non-custodial parent has had in the child's life for the preceding year. In other words, if the parent, the non-custodial parent, was essentially absent from the child's life, the court would be able to take that into consideration. I see that there are certain people here to talk about the bill. I don't see Representative Crummell, but I see Robin Pope.
All right. Ms. Pope, would you like to come? Yes, of course. Yes, you can bet. A little public hearing on this 3338. So.
Good morning, Chair Minnis and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us an opportunity to come in and talk to you about House Bill 3338. I believe Representative Crummell isn't here because he kind of left it in our hands when we last testified in House Judiciary, where this bill passed 8-0. It then went on to pass the full House with no opposition. And there are two sections to the bill. The first bill does a little bit of cleaning up on the language.
You ought to identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Robin Pope. I'm an attorney in private practice. My practice emphasizes adoption and related matters, and I'm the chairperson of the Oregon State Bar Standing Committee on Adoption. And I would ask that my written testimony that's being handed out be submitted for the record. Section 1 of House Bill 3338, the primary thing that it does is it amends subsection 3 of the statute to provide that the court may consider, among other factors the court finds relevant, whether the custodial parent of a child has attempted, without good cause shown, to prevent or impede contact between the child and the non-custodial parent, typically, whose parental rights would be terminated, typically by a step-parent adoption. That's a lot of the adoptions covered by ORS 109-324 are step-parent adoptions. And this part of the bill, Representative Crummell has a constituent who was very concerned about what had happened to her, and she testified at House Judiciary about her circumstances. Essentially what happened there is she lost her parental rights in a step-parent adoption when the custodial parent, in her opinion, had prevented her over a period of several years from having any meaningful contact with her son. She wasn't allowed to have phone contact. She sent letters that were returned. She wasn't allowed to have meaningful visitation with him. They all lived in Florida when they were divorced. The father moved here with the child, and it was very difficult for her because of her financial circumstances to maintain that contact. She ultimately lost her parental rights and went to Representative Crummell and talked to him about this. She and I and Representative Crummell spent a great deal of time talking and working on this bill and coming up with compromise language. At that point, Kathy Ledesma from DHS and some people from the Oregon Judicial Department also joined in, and we reached compromise language on the entire bill, and that's when it went through House Judiciary and through the full House, and then we're here today. Subsection 2 of the bill pertains to consent in adult adoptions, which do happen in Oregon, but they are not under the purview of DHS. They are primarily, exclusively, under the purview of the court system in Oregon. And Judge Rita Cobb, who's a Washington County judge handling probate and adoption matters, came to me and said that she'd been seeing many instances of what she suspected was senior fraud, where a senior would come in petitioning the court to adopt an adult they barely knew, essentially a caregiver they'd known for maybe a couple of months. And once they adopted that adult caregiver, that person would become their legal child, thus circumventing any oversight by the court that you would normally have in either a guardianship or a conservatorship process. And Judge Cobb was very concerned about that. She's seen several cases. We've since talked to other judges. There's a judge in Marion County, and we have Judge Lowe in Clackamas County, Judge Welch in Multnomah County, who's the presiding family law judge, and they are concerned about these same situations happening in their counties. The Oregon Judicial Department, I believe, sent an email out to all the judges across the state to seek comment from them to see if there was any opposition, and what we, from comments that they received back, we tweaked our language a little bit and came up with language that we all agreed on, made sure that there was no fiscal impact, and we have House Bill 3338. So the primary focus of subsection 2 is to set up a process whereby the judges in the state, if a case comes in front of them where we lawyers call it, we say it smells, it doesn't smell right, and so the judges want a chance to be able to step back, have some procedures where they can look at the situation, they can see, determine whether or not the senior is being defrauded, and if so, there's a process set up in the bill for a hearing. There's a process for notice to either the spouse of the petitioner or the grown children of the petitioner. Basically, what we want to try to do is let the judges have the discretion to look at these cases that where they suspect some kind of fraud or incompetence.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Senator.
In the case of an adult adoption, if the adoptee has living parents, what is the legal status of an adoption like that?
What would happen there is if you're adopted by another person, that would terminate the parental rights of your living parents.
So, Mr. Chairman, is that a separate proceeding? Does that have to be
no.
Done first?
I'm sorry, Chair Minnis and Senator Burdick, that would not be a separate proceeding. It would be part and parcel of the same proceeding. Would it be helpful if I just briefly described a typical adult adoption, what happens there?
Go for it.
Okay. Chair Minnis and members of the committee, you have an adult petitioner who is asking to adopt an adult child, essentially, someone over the age of 18. And that child will often have living legal parents. Typically, these adoptions concern a step-parent situation where, for whatever reason, the adoption did not occur while the adult child was a minor. Once they become an adult, the consent of their parents is no longer needed to complete the adult adoption. Bless you. So, And in that adoption, you are asking not only that the petitioner become the legal parent of this adult child, but you're also asking that the parental rights of their living parents be terminated. And something that happens not in all adult adoptions, but in some, the birth certificate can be amended to reflect the change in legal parents.
Well, that's interesting.
I was hoping somebody would willfully adopt me. Hopefully,
there's no maximum age for being adopted.
So far, no luck. All right, other questions?
Yes.
Senator Walker.
I have questions, but I don't know. Ms. Ledesma might be able to answer them. You haven't testified yet, but I do have questions because I always have concern about adoption bills. And my concern is this. We have several women in prison who have children, a lot of women in prison with children, men as well. But I'm finding that women are losing their parental rights simply because they're in prison. And I'm very concerned about how this bill would impact that, because they may not be able to have contact with their child because the child is an infant. They have no way to have the child's in foster care or whatever. But explain to me how we wouldn't take away those rights from incarcerated people.
Okay. Senator Minnis and Senator Walker, I think this bill could actually help women in that situation. And that was, it's akin to the situation of Representative Crummell's constituent, where she was prevented from having contact with her child by the other parent. Now, that other parent, we could instead substitute the fact that the woman is in prison. I think that someone in prison, they could still attempt to have some form of written contact or perhaps telephonic contact. What we're really trying to do is to show that the custodial parent has done the preventing, not that the non-custodial parent hasn't attempted.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense
mm-hmm.
to you? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Ledesma may have more to add to that.
Chairman, Senator Walker, for the record, I'm Kathy Ledesma. I'm the Program Manager for Adoptions at the Department of Human Services. Actually, as we worked on the amendments to this bill, that was one of the sections that we and Department of Justice were very delighted about. Section 1, Subsection 3, we think that it actually strengthens the existing statute to prevent that exact scenario from happening. Unfortunately, it's not an uncommon occurrence here in Oregon for a birth mother, it would be the usual situation, to hide a child from a birth father to prevent them from getting custody if she's planning adoption. It's vindictive on her part to say, if I'm not going to parent, you're not going to parent either, and I don't even want you to know about this baby. This strengthens the statute to reduce the likelihood that that will happen. Likewise, if a mother's in prison and attempts to have contact, and that contact can be a letter, a telephone call, and then she could later prove or allege that she had been prevented from making that contact, this really strengthens the law on her behalf.
Okay. That's very good to hear. And I do worry about that situation where the women will hide their birth, the birth of their child from the birth father, mm-hmm. and the birth father has absolutely no knowledge and no rights. And it's the thing that I warned my children about why you need to protect yourself, because you get in those situations where you have no say. So mm-hmm. I appreciate this bill on making it more secure for those parents. Thank you.
All right. We had a bill earlier in the session dealing with parental adoptions. It seems that there's some similarities here. And I guess I'm asking that question with respect to a parent who might take a child from Oregon to another state and then preclude contact. Would this facilitate a person who's still residing in Oregon from losing?
Senator Minnis, so if I understand your concern...
I'm not sure I understand the question either.
Okay.
They seem to be related in a sense. I think the facts in the case that was brought for the parental abduction was that a parent mm-hmm. took the children from Oregon to another state and then refused to allow any contact, notwithstanding the fact that there was a custody order that allowed it. But I guess it's really unrelated. It's similar but unrelated.
Senator Minnis, it may be related. The problem with that situation where the parent abducted the child and took them out of the state of Oregon, I guess I'm assuming they would not then try to file an adoption in Oregon. They'd go to the other state.
Right.
So unfortunately, this would not prevent that situation. What this would do, Representative Crummell's constituent was in Florida with her ex-spouse and child there. The father moved the child here and effectively prevented contact. And so what we're trying to do here is say that's not appropriate. And if you've done that, the court gets to look at it and perhaps say no to the step-parent adoption because you've wrongfully impeded contact between a parent and a child.
All right. Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. You're the only folks signed up. Representative Crummell's not here, though. Work session here.
Thank you.
Senator Burdick.
Senator what?
Burdick.
I would move House Bill 3338 to the Senate floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 3338 before the Senate with a two-pass recommendation. There are no amendments. Discussion on the motion.
I like this bill. I'd be curious to know if Representative Crummell's constituent was able to go back to court and nullify the adoption, but I'll find that out that story later.
I think this only applies to future situations, if I'm not mistaken. Cases. This doesn't apply retroactively.
No, we wanted it to be prospective and not retroactive. Representative Crummell, when he drafted the bill originally, it was prospective and not retroactive. He was very clear to his constituent and informed me that he would not want it to be retroactive.
All right.
Thank you.
Any further discussion or comments? Any objections to the motion? No objections. Motion passes. Senator Starr, do you like these kind of bills?
Oh, yes.
You do? Okay. Senator Starr gets to carry this. Now, we're going to do a work session actually on 3540.
Correct.
So the intent here is to hear some additional amendments. Council, we've got two different sessions.
Yeah, we do, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, if you recall, House Bill 3544. Deals with a situation where an employee who is on commission, typically in the motor vehicle industry, is terminated, and how you deal with paying the commission, those types of things. There are two amendments. One is the A2. There are three amendments, actually. There's the dash A2, dash A3s, and Senator Burdick A5. I'll let Senator Burdick talk on the dash A5s, but the dash A2s and A3s deal with two technical fixes to the bill. One deals with there are other commissioned persons in the auto industry besides just the people who sell the vehicles. Apparently there are other people who sell add-ons, insurance, and arrange financing and those types of things, and that they also can be commissioned, and so the amendments are intended to include them. And then there was a technical amendment from the farm implement dealers to make sure that they were included in the bill, as I understand it. So those are the two, the A2s and A3s, and then the A5s deal with Senator Burdick's breastfeeding bill, which was heard earlier.
Senator Burdick.
The A5 amendments may look familiar to people. They look very much like Senate Bill 783 that passed the Senate a little over a month ago, as I recall. It got over to the House, and it was in the Business and Labor Committee without action when that committee closed. So it was such a good and popular bill, we decided to give it another chance, but with some revisions. I had talked to the chairman of the House committee, Representative Close, and she had some concerns about the bill, specifically the opportunity for people to file lawsuits if there were violations of the law, private causes of action, in addition to the administrative remedy. So the dash A5 amendments do not allow for private causes of action. It's administrative remedies only if women are not accommodated for breastfeeding their infants in the workplace. The other thing that was of concern was the prospect that businesses might have to add on a room to accommodate a breastfeeding mom. In that case, I got an opinion from legislative counsel that rarely, if ever, would that be the outcome because of the exemption in the amendment for hardship to businesses, which is retained in the Dash 5 amendments. Also, the Dash 5 amendments move the enforcement of the breastfeeding requirement from the discrimination division section to the wage and hour section of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, which means if there's an alleged violation, they would investigate and they would issue the employer a warning before any enforcement action is taken. So with a new law, I thought that was appropriate to have employers brought in to the process short of having an enforcement action. So I'm hoping these provisions give this measure smoother sailing in the House. It did pass the Senate with the stronger provisions, but I think it would still give the women, breastfeeding moms, the assurance they need that they can go back to work and continue to nurse their infants, which has wonderful benefits for both the mother and the baby and the employer, since absentee rates are lower. So the Dash 5 amendment does those things, and I would recommend that we add this on to the bill. And also, I apologize to Mr. Fuller over there, who I had asked that this be an add-on to the bill, and the initial draft was a gut and stuff, so I apologize to Mr. Fuller for almost giving him a heart attack. The Dash A5 amendments do not interfere with the underlying bill.
All right, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I misspoke before. The Dash A2 amendments are from the Farm Bureau, but they essentially allow any type of delivery of the final payment as opposed to just mailing it. And I said they included the Farm Bureau, but the A2s are really from the Farm Bureau. I'm assuming that the Farm Bureau folks would be included because they're selling these types of, they're commissioned and they're selling essentially automotive products, even though they're used in the agricultural field. Also, I don't see somebody here from LC. I did get a call. Oh, I'm sorry. That 3544-A5 amendments are beyond the relating clause of the bill. And I just wanted to make sure that that was on the record. So,
Mr. Chair?
All right. Senator Ringo.
I just had a question for counsel on Section 2 of the bill. And I'm trying to recall the earlier hearing on this. This deletes the portion about there must be payment within 48 hours, excluding Saturdays, Sundays, holidays.
We're talking about the original version of 3544A engrossed Section 2, or
yeah,
we're talking about the amendments, Section 2 of the amendments.
Well, maybe I got to be sure I'm tracking this. On Section 2 of the original bill, are those deletions included? Delete. No, it says deletes line 3 through 22. Okay.
I'm thoroughly confused. there is no section. The A engrossed version only has a section,
yes,
1, and there's
sorry.
A small subsection 2.
I'm sorry. I was looking at the non-engrossed version.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. We've got a few persons who would like to testify, I think, on some of the amendments. I'll allow that. Whomever. I'm sorry? No, I don't want to hear from counsel.
Do you want to hear on the other amendment, the Dash 5?
I assume you're here to talk on the Dash 5, yes.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. We have had a long history with this bill this session, and we do appreciate very much that there's been an attempt to take out at least the civil action and circuit court areas of the bill. Let me talk to you about some of the other concerns we have, because I do think over the long term they can be addressed. And some of it has to do with the language, and this is something we did put on the floor letters that we discussed. Reasonable efforts, whenever I come before this committee, I think it's pretty important for me to clarify that I'm not an attorney. I do have a brother who's an attorney, and he actually specializes in human resource law, and he's actually helped me kind of put some thoughts together on this. But the term reasonable does pervade the law. And meaning that, you know, the Americans with Disability Act and family leave laws use it regularly. asking for some guidance on the term reasonable is actually would be very helpful to us. For example, does reasonable, as you all know, women who breastfeed may breastfeed for 3 months, they might breastfeed for 6 months. How long is reasonable for the employer to accommodate the mother who might be expressing or breastfeeding during work? Undue hardship is also found in the ADA, and it's a very high standard. And there are multiple criteria that we can apply for this. But once we have to challenge it, for example, if we had to go to the Bureau of Labor, if we were getting a warning or something, the cost of providing, we would have to defend on the basis of showing things like the employer's resources and finances, just to show where that undue level is. And that is exactly what we have to do under ADA under the same type of terms. The wage and hour issues are very important, and what they trigger in this law are very important. If I have an employee with an 8-hour shift and she takes 2 15-minute breaks for expressing milk, in addition to the other breaks and meal periods that are required by law, does she then have to work another half hour during the day, or do we just deduct her pay for that 7.5 hours? And how does that comply with her other colleagues who might be working the same shift? And another critical point: what do we do about exempt employees? Some employees are exempt from overtime statutes, overtime pay statutes, and I'm a perfect example about that. And an employer cannot deduct wages on an hourly basis from a salaried employee who is exempt without blowing that overtime exemption. The provision for allowing reassignment, I think that's Section 5. This is actually another critical issue that we brought up in the floor letter and in other testimony on this bill. Under Oregon's family leave law, we are required to return when an employee comes back from family leave. We are required to return her or him to the exact same position, not an equivalent position, not sort of the same position, but the exact same position. So if I am a purse, let's say I'm a purse buyer for Meyer & Frank, I do all the purchasing, you cannot return me to a position of being a buyer for women's tailored clothing. I get my exact same position back. Now this makes a change to that and says that we can return them to a job that might, I don't say a purse buyer couldn't be reasonably accommodated for breastfeeding. I'm just trying to give you the examples that a human resource department would battle with. Now we have to make an additional accommodation for their job, and it seems that this issue really does need to be addressed about which law we're supposed to comply with. And then it's unlawful for under this amendment for an employer to demote. Now, we've just been told that we can put them into a position that might make it easier them for breastfeeding. What if that is, quote-unquote, a demoted level within the company? So those are some just concerns that a human resource lawyer or a human resource department would be struggling under this law. Some of the things that we have thought about when we've taken a look at 783 and other issues related to this bill are things that we can do that are not being done. And I think most of you know that the Department of Human Services has a program for businesses that businesses can contact and get information on how to accommodate their employees. And what we know at AOI is that the Department of Human Resources, the Department of Human Services, probably hasn't done a very good job of talking to the employer community about this program. And that would be a place where we would really suggest starting, because we were never contacted to communicate with our employer community about this program. I think there are a variety of programs out there already. I think the Department of Human Services says there's 32 Oregon companies that are that have the title of family-friendly or mother-friendly workplace. We would really work to encourage that in the next 2 years, and also to try and develop some real information about what companies do offer programs, where some problems are, and what a problem with such a mandate with reasonable and undue hardship would be. So those are our continuing concerns. It's nothing new. We do appreciate that the civil action language was taken out.
All right. Do you have those remarks summed up in written form?
They were probably included in our floor letters and such, but I can get it to the committee. That's not a problem.
I think I'd like you to provide that to the committee in written form on these amendments, if you could.
Not a problem.
All right. Anyone else wishing to testify? Okay. With that, I'm going to adjourn.